Hi, my name is Jordan. I am a special education teacher from the UK. I share my passion for everything communication, sensory regulation, and fun lesson ideas for my classroom of disabled pupils aged 4 to 11. Each week, I am joined by experts in the field, answering your questions and sharing our knowledge and experience working alongside our beautiful young people. Let's get started.
So these episodes are going to be a little bit different over August. We are going to relook at my favourite moments from the podcast from series one. We've had such amazing conversations this year, and thank you so much to everybody who has been on the podcast. You've been incredible, and thank you so much for all the listeners for your support so that we can continue this for series two from September. I hope you enjoy taking a look back at, my favourite moments.
That particular year of Hallie going to school, me leaving my job, that first year of the school refusals, and then the amount of meetings, and it's just, I can feel, even talking about it, I can feel the tightness, like, of just having to go to those meetings and have to try and advocate for myself, because again, I don't think teachers mean to do it. I don't think they mean to do it at all, but because of the process that they've got in place of, you've got to do this and you've got to do that, it makes, as a parent, you feel like that's blaming you. And it is just those, like, oh, bring her in this time, bring her in that time. So they're obviously, there's an attendance policy, and obviously that's what they're trying to meet. And I'm like, I'm not going to bring her in her pyjamas. I'm not going to bring her in screaming without a hair done, without a teeth brush. Like, it's just not fair.
Yeah.
She really doesn't want to come, to the point that she's not even allowing me to meet her basic needs. So, yeah. But then there's that, and then, like I say, there's that attendance policy that then.
Yeah, but so ultimately, I think you made the right decision, though, because she was communicating that she wasn't happy there, wasn't she? That's what she was communicating. If that behaviour and all that output of what she was doing, whatever it was words, it would have been saying, I don't feel safe there. I can't be myself there. Whatever it was, you know, she was communicating that she wasn't happy. So you had to be her voice in that moment, didn't you? And it sounds like you did that really well. Is there anything, looking back, now the fog's cleared a little bit 1 year on? Is it 1 year? One or two?
September was when I took them out of school.
Okay, so it's nearly
a year. I've been left my job about a year.
Okay. So maybe 9 months. Now the fog's cleared a little bit and you're a little bit more settled in what you're doing now, and we'll get that, into that in a bit. Looking back, is there anything that you wish you could have done, or that the school could have done differently?
I think for me, because I was at the time such a worrier and cared so much about what everyone was thinking about me, I don't think I was as transparent as what I could have been. Especially when it came to sort of how Hallie was struggling. And I think sometimes I wanted to go along with things, be a bit of a pleaser, be like, yeah, we can try that. Even though I know deep down that's not going to work. I know it's not. But the pleaser in me was wanting to go along with that to make them happy and look like a good person, I guess. And now I feel like I've gained that confidence. I wish I had it back then. I wish I had that voice back then to be a bit braver and to say exactly what I was thinking. So yeah, I would have definitely done that differently. I would have been just, more transparent in what we needed. From the school's point of view, I'm really not sure, because I did feel like they was trying really hard. They had, you know, even if they didn't have that a member of staff for her all the time, because she wasn't, I can't remember how many hours it was now, but it wasn't all the time, but they would always try to accommodate for her. So they'd take her outside. And so I always felt like they were trying, and they'd like done a little corner for her. They'd got her a swing for outside as well. So I always felt like they were really trying. I think what it comes down to is money. I really think that's what it is. It's that there wasn't enough money and they just couldn't do it. But they don't know if it feels like sometimes that they want you to make you, this might just be a parent thing, but like they make you want to feel like everything's okay, so you don't ask, so you don't want more. And yeah, you feel like you can't ask for anything. Like what you're getting is amazing. And you can't ask for anything more than that. I don't know if that makes sense.
It definitely makes sense, that the idea is, well, you're already getting so much already. You're already getting more than more than most, there isn't anything else. Even if that, even if that baseline isn't meeting your child's needs, which of course shouldn't be the case, should it? Like every child should be able to access education and be included. It sounds good to me that they were making reasonable adjustments and doing that to support Hallie and being there. Did you feel at the time that they wanted her there? Did you feel like they were really trying to include her and involve her in school as much as they could?
Yeah, I definitely think that they were. I know, like, she had a few friends and things like that. Like, it was actually quite strange because even, like, when I'd gone to watch my older daughter's sports day and I could see her in the outdoor area playing, and she did look so, when she was there, she looked happy. Like, I saw her, she looked happy. And, yeah, they would do all sorts for her. And it was just then when she was at home and then in the mornings, it was this extreme... Yeah. Didn't want to go. So, and I know there was a lot of masking going on, even though she wasn't a complete masker. So she didn't always, she would like sort of get upset and lay in the floor and refuse to do things. And she would do all of that if she really didn't want to do anything. Like pee, I know at times was a real struggle. So I know she would express herself, but there's also times where she would mask as well, because even though she would have like her nappy and her pushchair and things that other children didn't have, as soon as we got into the school, she would literally want me to, like, you know, the pushchair not to be in sight. So I knew there was things like that she was actually masking. So maybe it was that there was a lot of in school, maybe there was more masking going on than what I than what I know.
And then that makes sense, doesn't it, that she'd have found that exhausting, trying to suppress all of these things that are just you, must have just been absolutely exhausting for her. And often transitions are really tricky too, you know, that transition between home and school, crossing those thresholds, the walk-in, you know, school can't be predictable all the time, however much we try to be. We try to have a solid routine, we try to have visuals, but there are things that we can't foresee, like people being absent or a special day or a non-uniform day, that it happens. And that bubbling up inside you must be really anxiety provoking, not knowing what you were coming into, if that is what was happening. Like you say, it's no reflection on the school necessarily, it just isn't maybe the right environment for her
as well. Like, the more I've learned about PDA, there would have been so many demands there that she would have been going along with. Even though there were times like pee, I know there was certain things, like I say, that she would not do. And whether that was more a sensory or something was more triggering for her. But there must have been so many demands that she was going along with all day, every day. Because I would pick her up from school, and sometimes she would, as soon as she saw me, she would just burst into tears. And she'd either just like sort of run over to me, she'd put herself in the pushchair at that point. At the end of the day, morning she wouldn't, but end of the day she'd put a hood over, she don't want to see no one. And then it could take me 20 minutes, half an hour to get her to the car, because then she might try and get out of the pushchair. So it was, after school was just such a difficult time to get her home. And then she would get home and she wouldn't even still a little bit now, but it was a lot worse then. Like, she wouldn't eat food with people, she would just completely isolate herself, and it would just be from the moment of getting her home from school until whenever she went to bed, because she goes to bed quite late, it would just be meltdown after meltdown or isolation,
because she'd been holding it together all day, hadn't she? She'd been, you know, following the instructions and holding it together all day, and all of a sudden she's with her safe people, you, her family, she can go, oh, but then she's got nothing left. She can't follow she can't keep herself safe, she can't follow instructions or direction. It's too much. I'd love to hear your thoughts on sensory circuits.
Yeah, you're right. So much behaviour is sensory driven. Not all of it, of course. There's umpteen reasons why children behave the way that they do. And partly why I love working with kids so much is because I'm investigating, what could it be? because I need to know what it could be so that I can try and solve the problem. But a lot of the time, yes, it is sensory. It has a huge impact on somebody's ability to participate in their day, enjoy the things that they're doing, enjoy the environment that they're in. And if we can meet their sensory needs, then we can just make that whole day nicer for them. We've all got sensory needs, all of us. We all have our individual sensory preferences. For example, I like to work in silence. I like a really quiet environment. My teenage daughter likes to listen to music while she works. We're in the same room together. If we were in the same class, it becomes very hard because her needs are to listen to music, my needs are to have silence. So when we're doing sensory diets, for example, that's about trying to meet the individual needs of somebody and give them what they need to make that environment right for them. So give them more of the sensations that they need, take away some of the sensations that they don't need, and maybe give them more of sensations that they would find calming or regulating or grounding, whichever word you choose to use to apply that to. Where were we going there, Jordan? I've just gone off on a tangent there and gone, oh, hang on, bring me back to the question that you
sensory
asked.
Sensory circuits and sensory diet. So that's a way of making it individual, isn't it? So the music one is a great example, because you've either got music on or haven't. But what if we offer headphones maybe for a child that does want music? That is something that you could do in class that then doesn't impact everybody else.
Yes.
So I mean, like musical headphones, or headphones for a learner that doesn't want the music, or maybe pick carefully about what music you have on, or maybe it's actually white noise that helps them, and then actually that helps everybody. Maybe, you know, it's all about experimentation, isn't it?
And see what happens. It's not an exact science, so I can't look at a child and go, they need X, Y, and Z, and everything will be fine. It is trial and error to try and figure it out, especially if they can't tell us what it is that's going on, and lots can't because they may not have the cognitive ability. They may not have the verbal ability. If their interoception isn't good, they may not know why it doesn't feel right. They'll just know that it doesn't feel right. And we've got to help them unpick that.
And then, so is that sensory diets? That's more individual. What about sensory circuits? How does that fit in as part of that conversation?
Yeah, if we can get things right on an individual basis, that's brilliant. And I know you're using the term sensory diets. Quite like, there's a few other terms being floated around. I quite like sensory lifestyle as a bit of
because that means it's more consistent.
Yes, and it's what you need in the environment around you for your life. So that one feels quite nice to me. Sensory circuits are a really good way of meeting the needs of a lot of children most of the time, because we're giving them the input that regulates most children most of the time. And sometimes when we're in schools, we can't do all of the individual needs all of the time because it's the real world. Things don't always work that way. So sensory circuits can be a fantastic way of getting lots and lots of regulating movement input in for a child to really sort their nervous system out, if you like, so that the rest of the day becomes okay, becomes things that they can cope with. So it's a great, almost one size fits all with a few little tweaks. And sometimes we have to do the best we can with what we've got to work with, don't we? And movement, sensory circuits, sensory movement breaks, whatever we're calling them, can work brilliantly for that.
Yeah. There's like maybe a three-step approach. So alerting and then organizing and grounding. I've spoken about this lots before on my account if you're not sure. Do all children necessarily need to start with alerting, though?
That's a brilliant question. I might have to kiss you now for raising that one, you know.
Only because it's something I've been experimenting with. If they're already alert, do they need more alerting to like let it go in a safe way? Or are they already alert and you do organising?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I totally agree. Your traditional circuits have those three areas. And if you don't know where to start, that's a really great place to start. Do some alerting, do some organising, then do some grounding or calming activities. But no, you're right. Not all children need it. And like all good rules, they are there to be broken, aren't they? So not all children do need the alerting activities. If you've got a child who's already looking like they're a little bit in that fight flight zone, then actually an alerting activity might be really wrong for them. It might even take them further along that fight or flight response because it's scary and they're not in a good place to do it. So no, you can mix and match. You might have somebody that just wants some grounding activities or some calming activities, You might have somebody that needs lots more alerting activities. It might depend on the child. It might depend on the time of day. Maybe we arrive at school and we're sort of hyper alert because the transition and the morning has all been quite stressful, and we need to come in and have a little bit of a calming session, a little bit of a grounding session to feel okay to then go into class and carry on. Maybe after lunch, we've had a big dinner, we're a little bit sleepy. We need some more alerting stuff to wake us up and tune us into what's going on the world around us. So those, you can mess around with them and test it. See what happens. See what's right for the child. Our organising stuff is brilliant. It comes back to that proprioceptive input. We can't really go wrong with those on the whole. If somebody was in crisis, I perhaps wouldn't do it.
That.
But on the whole, they work for everybody. So they're a really good place to be.
And it's quite a wide span of organising activities, isn't there? There could be obstacle courses. So you're moving quite gross motor wise, rolling and all those kind of things, balancing. But also it can be some quite fine motor stuff. We do some threading and puzzles, and sorting is also organizing. So also within organizing, have a think about, does it look like gross motor balancing that they need, or does it look like quiet organizing and sorting alphabet, for example? Maybe that grounds them. I always like to explain it to my teaching assistants as, when I'm stressed, I like to write a list on my phone, like a little tick box, because that helps me see everything that I need and feel organized and in control. And that's basically what the organizing is offering for our children, whether that's getting their body in control in a quite a physical way, or sorting out all the thoughts in their mind. And lots of my learners find either sorting colours by rainbow order, or sorting the alphabet, or sorting numbers, makes things feel in control, because ultimately lots of our learners have so little control over their lives and their bodies and their voice and everything, that actually by giving them those opportunities to practice control within their special interests can be really regulating, even if they don't need the alerting and the grounding. So I really do like the organising part of it, actually. And then for me, the alerting and the grounding are quite child specific. I can think of some learners that I certainly wouldn't want to finish with grounding, because they're sluggish and slow normally, that certainly wouldn't help them focus or concentrate in whatever we're doing next if we were to finish with grounding. But same for lots of my learners. I've got lots of climbers and jumpers and throwers in my room, that if I was to do too much alerting, then we also weren't going to get focus and still either. So it is also about knowing your class and that flexibility within that as well, isn't there?
Absolutely, yes. Feel free to break the rules sometimes and do what works for your individual learner.
Yeah, I feel
and
like
remembering their individual preferences as well, because what might be calming to one person might not be fun digging the garden. That would be a great proprioceptive input. I don't want to do that. Thank you very much. I really, really don't want to do that. I'd rather go and do something else. So again, it's recognizing that although it might be a grounding activity for somebody, that might really wind them up because they don't like it.
Yeah, so it could meet their needs on a practical level really well, but actually if it's not of interest to them and it feels forceful in a way, then that's actually not going to be regulating. In fact, that's going to be quite heightening, even if the actual thing is grounding. Grounded.
And that's sometimes where I see things go wrong in classes, because you do something that the textbook says should do this thing and it doesn't, and you don't know why. And it's always worth thinking about individual preferences and how the activity's been done.
I suppose it's about approach as well, isn't it? You know, how are you approaching it? What are the adults doing in that situation? Are they controlling the activity and kind of forcing the activity? Or are they just doing the activity and making it as fun and as motivating as possible? Are they planning for activities that they know the children will like because they're really similar to what they're already naturally doing, or their special interests? It's how it's sold as well, I think. If I was to say, like, my children love the obstacle courses, they really love it. But if I was to say to lots of my pupils, if I was to stand there and say, right, off you go, like, and treat it like a work task, or treat it like a, you know, this is something for you to do and you have to do it and then you can get what you want, it wouldn't work. It wouldn't be fun. It wouldn't be motivating, and they wouldn't get anything out of it. In fact, they'd find it really heightening or boring. Whereas if all of the supporting adults are doing it and being silly and modelling how fun it is and adapting to whatever the children want to do, and it being quite child-led in that way, it makes the exact same activity a very, very different outcome.
Absolutely, yes. Children learn through play. They want to engage in things that are fun. Yeah, get release your inner child, I always say in my training. Yeah. This is your license to release your inner child. Get in there and play and enjoy it.
Do you battle or configure the whole age appropriateness conversation? I know some people have quite strong opinions on it being age appropriate or stage appropriate. Like, how do you, as with secondary school pupils, I can imagine it comes up a lot and is in your mind quite a lot. How do you navigate that?
It's so good. Like, you're so true, especially when it comes to stories, because I think that actually stories in English, you know, the children where they are in terms of their levels, you'd be like, but then that's the book. And I'm like, well, that's not really age appropriate.
Kind of like early years. Or
yeah.
Preschool kind of even stuff.
So, yeah, definitely. And then the books are sometimes just, they're not appropriate at all because they are so young in age. And also I'm like, you've now in secondary, you've probably potentially seen this book as well a significant amount of times. Why are you going to bother listening to me?
Like, we're going on a bear hunt is like...
Yeah, exactly.
Over you, Dinesi.
Yeah. So, I think me and my co-teacher next door, we work really hard on trying to find books that are not only given that sensory, we can allow it to give them that sensory experience, but we just adapt it. So like the book now, for example, is such a good example of a book that has a lot of language in. If you were to look through the book, it's got quite a lot of language in. But the first look, I think, to be fair, the first look I always give any book is like, oh my gosh, right, okay, challenge accepted. Because it's like, oh, not again. But it's just taking it and stripping it back. So it's still a book about deadly animals and it's still a book about animals. But rather than all the other language in between, it's just, you know, what does the shark, where's the shark live? What's his deadly feature? Sharp teeth, done. And then in that, on our PowerPoints, we'll make a PowerPoint for it. We'll sort of just scan the book in. And it just has really simple using widgets, using symbols, has very much just a sentence, done. Because then the book is still appropriate. It's then not sort of a early years style book that just isn't appropriate. It's got real pictures in, you know, it's got all of those things. But
yeah, I love that it's non-fiction. Yeah. That's so great.
Yeah,
sensory exactly. Stories can be non-fiction.
Yeah, exactly. And I just think like we then just do a lot of adapting just to make it meet the needs. And you know, we have had battles before. We're like, no, this book, we can't do that book. It's not appropriate because it's far too advanced. The language in it is so complex. Actually, our journey to try and make that, it just wouldn't work. So let's try and think about a different book.
So I suppose if you're focusing, what are we actually getting out of this? What are the kids getting out of this? What is our main aim here? Okay, it's for sentence building, right? Does this motivate the children in order to do that? And if the answer is yes, like about deadly animals, I find that's incredibly motivating and interesting. Great. If it's a classic book that isn't really interesting them, isn't keeping their engagement, you're not even really enjoying, like, it's going to be pointless, isn't it? And equally so, a preschool book that might be stage appropriate for them as far as their understanding goes. Yeah, like they've heard it before. It's not going to engage them because it's not exciting to them.
No.
It doesn't engage them in that way.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting, actually, like literally on Friday, we had some talk for writing training. And we were talking about that, about like the appropriacy of some of the books and that age, because it is really tricky because, you know, you have to look at like, right, they are secondary. We've got to make sure that we are fitting it right for them, but that also it meets their needs, but it's also engaging enough. And it's not something that is just on repeat all the time. It's not just, well, let's just give them this book. And the one that they use is Little Red Riding Hood. And I just thought it was a really nice example of the fact that actually there's so many adaptations of that book and it, or, you know, the classic story. There doesn't have to just be the classic story. Like, we can adapt it just like we do everything else. You know, we adapt everything. So why don't we just adapt it to make sure we're meeting the needs and their age range rather than just,
yeah,
we're going on a bear hunt or the Gruffalo, you know.
Well, that's almost the lazy way out, isn't it? Gruffalo, bear hunt. Yeah, exactly that. It's the lazy way out because it's just hand of surprise is another one.
Yeah.
Because it lends itself so well to sensory, of course. And it does make a great sensory story. But I think what you said is a really great point. Yes, they might be into In the Night Garden. Yes, they might be into Teletubbies too. That's cool. Like, that's awesome. I'll celebrate all their interests. That's awesome. But it's the idea of that actually they've repeated this so many times. Yeah. Is this engaging or interesting to them? What else can they get out of it? And actually, that's quite lazy, I think. Quite lazy teaching. Whereas how exciting to get a new book in a new way
But actually, taking all the fundamentals that Gruffalo and Bear Hunt are so great for is repetitive language, simple sentence structure, it's predictable. All of those things you could put into any book if you put the time in.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing, you know, it's not easy. And, you know, I do think that's where in SEN, you know, there isn't just, well, you're lucky if it's not just you and there is a team of you. And I think that's the thing, you know, me and my co-teacher, it is just great because I'm like, right, this term wasn't my term, it was her term. So obviously we work together, but she's the one that goes through the book, sorts it all out. And I just think it really helps them because it's like, yeah, we can make this work. It's just, we just got to put that teacher hat on that we do have to, and we know our students so well, as to what bits about this book are they going to really, really love? And what parts can we, and, you know, they've loved it. And the sensory elements as well, you know. We've got tongues to stick out for the frogs. We've got like a lion tongue that we have that's all like spiky, and they just loved it. And also so many of them just love animals anyway. It's such a, you know, like little, they just love it. Like, and there's so many different things you can link it to.
Yeah.
And I think, like you say, like, you know, lots of the children here as well, we do have those obsessions in other areas, and it's about celebrating that in a different way, you know, or bringing that into the curriculum in another way. You know, for example, doing big and small, bringing up big and small of symbols of things like the Teletubbies. You know, why don't we just do a sorting activity of big and small with Teletubbies? Like, that's fine. We can introduce whatever your likes are into the curriculum, but we can also inject other things.
It doesn't mean it just has to be that. Let's expand your interest. Let's expand your knowledge.
Yeah.
Rather than getting stuck, like, that's cool, we can celebrate that, but also, have you seen this? Like, this is also so fun. I think you'll love this.
Absolutely. And I think that's just what's really, like, yeah, it's really powerful and really good, and it's also important. And do you know what, if it's like, well, okay, it's clear that you do not like this, that's fine, because that's also, you know, good life skills to go, right, I don't like this book, or I don't like this part, I've made it very clear I don't like this, and that's okay. Like, we hear you, we listen to you.
Yeah,
you
know? Protest and rejection is great communication, right?
Yeah, a lot of times I'm like, right, I hear you. Like, you don't like this, that's absolutely fine. I'm going to stop. We don't have to carry on. We'll do something different, you know. But it's also about just getting that fine balance, I think, of injecting new things so that it is exciting for them, and we can give them some new experiences, whether that be through storytelling, whether that be through our curriculum, but also celebrating themselves and what their likes are, and, you know, how we can bring that into it as well.
If you were changing your story weekly, there is absolutely no way you could build a story so rich and engaging and spend all that time creating that, getting the resources, buying the resources, making it so suitable to them, and also getting them to know it enough and hear it enough that they know what to do and find it predictable every week. Like, you just couldn't do that. It's only because you're doing a story a term that you're able to invest your time and energy and finances in to make this story like the best thing ever, using all these incredible resources. So if you're a teacher hearing this thinking, oh, I'd love to be able to do this, maybe just look at your timetable, maybe look at your planning, your long-term planning, and stretch it out a little bit. Give yourself that time to really focus and open up what this topic could really offer.
Yeah, and I think also when it comes to things like sensory stories, you've got to just go with it. You know, you've got to just allow that time, you know, however long that might take, because there'll be parts of the story where it's very clear my students aren't a big fan of that page. They don't quite like the part of the end. Like, okay, that's fine, we can move on. Or there's another part of the book that they absolutely love, that sensory immersive experience. I'm like, we're going to sit in this for a little bit because you're enjoying it and it's nice to see, and we're getting some feedback, we're getting a to and from here. And I think, like, literally like you say, like, it is good, and it does take time and it does take resourcing, you know. Like, it won't be probably next week that I'm like, right, what's next term's book, let's start putting it all together, because that is, and you know, that is just part of teaching, we just constantly are looking up me next. But having that time, and I just think that's also really important, just to sit sometimes in that time. You know, I do sensory day of the week, which you might have seen on my Instagrams before, and like, my children just love that. And we just sit in that sensory experience, put on the relaxation music, we have the bubbles, we have all the toys and the smells associating with that day, and we just sit and just enjoy that whole sensory experience. And I just think, I get that asked a lot, to be fair, on social, like, how do you find the time for this? And it's just a 10-minute pocket. Like, if that's all you can find is a 10-minute pocket in your timetable, I guarantee you'll see some incredible things, because I just...
And so it's amazing things are set up. Yeah. You repeat it, right? So do you do that every morning, that sensory day of the week?
Yeah, we'll either do it in the morning before, sort of like in before lunch, or we'll do it when we come back after lunch. It's very much, but it's all there. So like, you know, there's a pocket. And again, it did take time to set up. It does take time to print the visuals, get that together, find as many red themed fidget toys as you can, and then go back to it and go, right, yep, they've been chewed. We need to make sure we're changing those up and all that kind of stuff. And the scents. But it's now it's there, it's done. You know, we just add to it. That's all I'm doing now, is just adding to it. And yeah, we do it every day. And it's just a really lovely experience for them. And it was something I started last year. And I was like, gosh, and I was just seeing like a complete, almost like zen, like relaxation, like everyone's shoulders sort of just drop. I'm like, yeah, nice.
So they find it relaxing. And also it is helping them to feel grounded in the week, right? They know what day of the week it is, which gives them some comfort and some, they can predict what might happen that day. Yeah, it's a blue Friday and it's coconuts. And it's a swimming day. And they were like, yeah. I know that blue and coconut now means swimming. And they're kind of slowly piecing those things together. I can be excited that it's a swimming day now. Whereas maybe, I don't know, maybe if you come in on a Monday, they might be predicting it. And then we might think, oh, where is all this behavior come from? Where's all this anxiety come from? Well, they thought it was a swimming day. Whereas we're telling them, aren't we? This isn't a swimming day. Hopefully it will ease their anxiety and help their understanding.
Absolutely.
And then maybe reduce unsafe behaviors.
I've worked in special needs schools, and obviously the range of need is so high, but it always comes down to there's autism sessions or there's sensory processing sessions and there's quiet sessions, but even still, she still couldn't get in. And I always remember specifically, we went to a local trampoline park and they were advertising, there's a sense session, there's a sense session, there's a sense session. And I was like, great, because she loves rebound at school. We have a trampoline in the garden. We can make it work between us. Like if we take enough people, we can lift her up out of her chair and onto a trampoline. And she'll love that. And we turned up and they were like, okay, like you're here for the session. And we were like, yeah, like let's sign in, whatever, did all the waivers, walked through the door. And the only way to get to the trampolines was up steps. And I said, well, she can't actually get in. And they went, oh, well, you have to carry her up. I said, but you wouldn't say that to someone else. You wouldn't say that to a child who was walking. And yeah, you just wouldn't say that. So things like that were really important, that actually, if a child's coming in a wheelchair, be that powered, a small one, self-propelling, whatever they're doing, that they could get in the venue initially. But then even still, once they're in, that the point of access wasn't just that they can get in the venue. The doors need to be double doors. They need to be automatic. There needs to be buttons. There needs to be a change in places, mobile hoist, ceiling hoist, whatever that kind of setup is. There needs to be an option. And yes, even now, we don't have a ceiling hoist in half the rooms because we hire a local SEND primary school. And obviously, they are not as adapted as they possibly can be because they're suiting a massive range of needs. But if a child wants to get out in soft play, we have a mobile hoist that we can take to soft play. And in an ideal world, we'd just have ceiling tracking everywhere. But obviously, we can't do that unless we had our own venue. But at the same point, they can still get out in a mobile hoist. I can take it outside. We can take it into the hall. We can take it wherever we need to. But if they need a change in places, we've got the bed with sides. It's comfy. It's not just a massage bed that's been put in the cupboard and gone, oh, that's suitable for you to get changed on. It's private. It's bespoke. We've got all them things. And that, for me, especially because my sister, I always say, if she can't get in and access it to the way we'd want to go somewhere and access it, then there's no point doing it. Because there's going to be children with needs just as high as hers, but also children that need even greater need. And if we can't even meet at that level, it's not inclusive.
Yeah,
and
I think that's a massive, if you can't meet their basic needs of toilet access, you know, then you can't call yourself a SEND session, can you? And I can totally see where that frustration comes from. Years of attending these, oh, finally there's a session that we can both enjoy, and then you can't even get through the door.
It's
false advertising, isn't it?
And exactly.
I know they call it greenwashing when it's about eco stuff. Maybe it's disability washing, you know? They're just ticking a box to say they're doing a SEND session. And there is so much more to meeting. Like if you actually cared about the disabled community, then you would make fully accessible sessions. And also, can we just say, not on a random time on a Saturday that no one else wants anyway?
Honestly, I was going to say this about that the trampoline. So the trampoline centre. And I'm sure families who listen to this who are local to us will know exactly who I'm talking about. Their centre session is on Sunday at 4 till 6. My sister's like on wind down time. She loves to see Bibi's bedtime story every night. She's ready to watch that. She's not ready for a day, like an hour trip out to trampolining. Like even me as an adult, I'd be like, oh, that's a bit much for me on a Sunday, especially if she has school the next day. Like that's
totally inappropriate, isn't it?
It's just, it's not appropriate at all. And the amount of sessions we've been to where it's on like a Wednesday night at 8 o'clock at night. And it's like, well, no, she wants to go to bed. Like, if you actually saw how much she's done today, when it's physio, swimming, she's done all these things. She's exhausted come 4 o'clock, let alone then finding the energy to come out again. But also then on us as a family to extend our day even more so, because I think they often forget that actually parents and siblings who are supporting with the care, when they go to bed, that is usually your time off and that's your bit of respite. But if we're then dragging the day even longer, as much as that experience is nice, we've then not had that decompressing time, or maybe we're preparing medication or doing food prep or something in that time. We've had to shove all that back, and then maybe we're not going to bed for 2 hours later because we've wanted to do something nice and then probably had an issue anyway, or she's then tired because of it. So it's kind of, yeah, but that still happens everywhere. Every session we see, the times are just so inaccessible.
If you could use this platform, or imagine you're in a room and all of these big businesses are listening.
Yeah.
From a sibling's point of view, what would you say to them to help them understand the importance of having accessible, realistically timed, fully accessible sessions for you as a sibling and you as a family and for your sister?
Yeah, I think they need to look at it in a sense that her needs are not separate from our needs, and that it should suit us, not her. And that isn't a way of saying, oh, okay, well, she can come at this time, but you get to tag along as well. Actually, no, we want to come on our schedule, which is on a Saturday afternoon or on a Saturday morning, or we've just been out for lunch on a Sunday afternoon and we want to go and do something afterwards. We're not the second thought. We shouldn't be the afterthought to your normal sessions, which I think is what they often see it as, oh, we can't make as much money on this session. Yeah, but you could if you actually put it at the right time. And they often don't see that point of view. But I always say you have to have lived experience, and businesses should be consulting local schools, local parents, care forums, whatever that looks like, to say actually what does work, because they're just doing it as a, we've made it inclusive but not accessible, so you're completely missing the point. But yeah, I think they need massive input from families, siblings, even the young people themselves, because I know so many young people who could say, I don't want to do that at 8 o'clock at night, I want my bedtime routine, I want whatever that is. And that they need to move that to the daytime and ultimately try it. If it doesn't work, fair enough, that's completely fine, because not everyone wants to do those things. But arguing that, oh, it's not going to sell, it's not going to make us as much money. Well, how do you know? You don't know until you try. And we always say that at Ladybug Lodge, we don't know if something's going to work until we try. And that has been things that haven't worked or families haven't enjoyed. But if we didn't do that, we wouldn't get the feedback. Whereas all these companies get now is negative press because families aren't happy with it, but then they don't do anything about it. So yeah, it's an interesting one. They need to really kind of see it as a, if this was a normal family, for example, what would they do? They'd come at 2 o'clock on a Saturday, 8 o'clock.
Looking back to when you were a child and a young teen, if you had really great and broad access to those activities that you could enjoy with your sister at a suitable time that were totally fun for both of you, just like you offer yours, you know, if you had a really broad section, if you that was available to you when you were younger, what difference and impact would that have had on you as a sibling and for your sister and maybe your parents as well?
Well, I think it'd just be massive. Like, we offer in the holidays especially, which is so loved, is swimming in a hydrotherapy pool. And it's a private session. There's only 6 people in the pool at a time. The pool is heated, which is such a key thing for my sister, that if we go to a standard swimming pool, it's too cold and she wants to get out. And because of her needs, she can obviously do a bit of physio in the pool and she needs hoisting in. If we could have done that every weekend since she was little, the difference in her leg mobility, her arm mobility, all of that could be astronomical now. But we will obviously never know, which I think is really hard, because she can swim nearly, which is incredible for her. But if she had that regular input all the time, we could go swimming all the time and not be thinking about, oh, we're working, we're not playing. Actually, she probably could play and join in with some activities and games. Whereas now, because we haven't had that time, we're so quick to go, oh, let's do a bit of physio, let's do this. And it takes the fun out of it. Whereas if we'd been doing this forever, now it would just be fun, which we're kind of getting to that point now. But when I was 12, I would have loved to have got in the pool and been diving around and splashing her and soaking her and not worrying that, oh, she's going to swallow too much water, or she's not going to react in time, or we're going to need 3 people in the pool. Actually, she would have just been able to play. And I think for me, when I was younger, because I didn't have other siblings, I very much relied on friends to get like fun moments with. And yes, we've had amazing experiences and memories that I will never forget, but there's things that I'm going, oh, but I've never done that with her. And I've only done that with my friends, or she's never seen me do this, or we've never done that together. And I think that would have been the big difference. But I think especially for my mom, trying to split that time was so hard because my sister's needs are obviously so much greater than mine. But for her to have maybe had some times where she can just sit and watch us play and not be thinking, I need to do this soon, or I've got to do this, or I'm starting to think about this, or I've got to drop Josie here soon because I need to take Rosie to this. She wouldn't have had that constant kind of monologue and blocking in her mind that she has to do all these things. She might have just been able to sit and go, this is really nice. They're playing. I can do something leisurely because I'm not thinking about it too much. We did have obviously amazing experiences, but even now, I think it's only been in the last 4 or 5 years that we've done things that Rosie's really loved. Like we went kayaking for the first time, she went rock climbing and she loved that. And we have traveled further to do that. But we would have done that every single year if we knew it was an option. Whereas it's only really started to come up now, which I think is a shame because obviously as she's got bigger, her needs have got bigger and things are now less accessible because she's heavier and we can't lift. Whereas when she was 5 or 6, we would have easily done these activities quite often. Whereas now we have to be limited because of her tiredness or our backs or whatever that is, or manual handling equipment. Whereas if she could have done that when she was really young, it could have been something that she's done every single year, every month, or been an activity that she actively chooses for, actively wants to do. Whereas now, she hasn't really had that and it's a bit more sporadic, like, oh, we're going to try this. And so I think that would have just been massive for us to have.
Do you have any advice for an anxious child not wanting to attend school? So many.
I know. I mean, my advice first thing is whether it's their own child or no child in your class, is just trying to work out what it is that is causing that anxiety. Is it something that's happening on the transition? Is it something that's happening at school? Take the learning out of the equation at the moment. We need to make sure this person is feeling safe at school. And obviously at the moment they're not, and it's trying to identify.
Definitely. And I'm assuming if they're a parent, it's advocating for their almost fight in their corner of, look, can we just not wear uniform? Can we just come an hour late and just come for half an hour? Can they just work with this teacher in the corridor under the table? Can they just wear, you know, trainers and bring their teddy? I've got a student that comes in with a blanket over their head.
I've got someone who comes in with a dressing gown, dark glasses, with a rag,
whatever works.
What does it bother me if I try? Why doesn't bother me?
It really doesn't.
You know, but that's not what we should be doing.
Make whatever the timetable desirable for them. Maybe they just join PE if that's their thing. And then we work up from there. Backwards chain it. You know, just start with the things that you know they can achieve. And then hopefully they build confidence and we build confidence. Because often they're feeling the parents' anxiety because it's so much pressure because they've got to go to work and da, da, da. And then the teacher's anxiety because they've got to keep them here because mum said we can't call her because she's at work today or whatever. You know, there's so much anxiety around it that's not even anything to do with the child. Let's see what works. Let's see how we can work with that, because otherwise the alternative is they will be home all the time. So if we can get them into school even for half an hour at first and work and then build on that, that would be good. But have it be because of the child's best interest to have half an hour, be it half an hour at school, not because it's in the school's best interest to have half an hour at school. So let me be really clear about that. This is the child leading the time and the child leading the timetable, not the staff can't cope for more than half an hour. That's not what I'm talking about. That's a whole different gossip. If the child can only cope with short stints, certain lessons, certain teachers, certain areas, start there.
Take the demand off, definitely.
And it might just be the transition alone is enough. So it might just be the first few days of just driving to the gate, giving a high five to the teacher and going home again. And that is seen as a success. Yeah. I've had a couple of refusers that have dropped siblings off and then expected to go home again, and it ended up as it was too loud in class, or it's too busy, or they weren't being seen, heard, played with, understood. They wanted a break from their sibling. You know, there's so many reasons why they'd want to, and it's just about unpicking that, isn't it? And again, like we started right at the beginning, creating that heaven for them, creating that that amazing environment that, of course, they want to be in and feel safe in. And yeah, if you're a parent, you could know all of this stuff. And you're like, yeah, I know, but the school aren't listening.
Hammer the school with information, you know, keep at it. You know, yeah. I mean, that, you know, you always hear of, you know, staff saying, oh, we've got a difficult parent here. And it's like, no, they're advocating for their child, job. You know, good
yeah,
for you.
I always good say to parents, don't worry about being that parent.
No.
Because that's the only way to get things done. And actually, part of the role of the SEN parent, you don't choose this role, but you kind of find yourself in this never-ending fight, basically. And unfortunately, that does come with the role, and lots of you do it incredibly well. It shouldn't be the case, but it is.
It's always a fight, isn't it, for parents? And it's it breaks your heart. We know that the system's broken at the moment, but I always think if I've got a parent who I know of who's managed to win this support and get this access to this and that, and my response was good for them.
And can I email them to find out how? I've done it before, actually. If I hear a parent that's written this letter or whatever and got funding or got this, open the doors for something that they couldn't or whatever, I say, can I see your email thread? Can you forward it to me? Because, and do you mind if I share it with other parents that are in a similar situation to you? And very rarely will they say no, because they know exactly where they're at. I did it with my year sevens that didn't have the school place. Our school didn't have a year seven place, and his parents sent me everything. There was legal statements, there was the people CC'd into it that all needed to, it just makes it so much easier, doesn't it? If we're all kind of helping each other out in that way. Yeah, but you're right. It's a shame that we have to do it in the first place. Okay, I think this might be our last one.
Go for it.
Maybe you pick one and I pick one?
Yeah, I've got one to finish. Go for it.
Okay. What advice do you have for when a child starts to recognise their differences to their peers, or are self-conscious of it? They don't want differentiated work, or they don't want to wear ear defenders, or they don't want to fidget. I personally use my supporting adults. So not to mock or mimic, but genuinely, my supporting adults in my class are neurodivergent. Yeah. So I've got some adults that like fidgets. I've got some adults that need weighted blankets. I've got some adults that find noise overwhelming. So we model the strategies that we would want our children to use: ear defenders, weighted blankets, fidget tools, taking a break and saying it verbally, refusing consent when I ask them if they want to have a turn in attention autism. If they don't want a turn, they say no thank you and stay in their seat. I think utilizing those supporting adults as models to genuinely meet their needs, fake it too, I suppose, but actually it's even more powerful if they genuinely have those needs, but voicing the whys and what they're doing, then the children, it might embed a culture of this is actually perfectly okay.
And building the self-esteem of that child as well, isn't it? I was about to say, role modeling completely, and knowing that it's okay. And it's so hard to, it's easy for me to say, to boost their self-esteem and to know that it's okay to be different, because, peer pressure, growing up as a young person in day and age.
But it's hard enough in this world anyway, let alone when you're aware. I often say to people that I know non-speaking level 3 autism is a challenge. It comes with lots of its challenges. Mm-hmm. But my heart always breaks for those that are different enough, but aware of it. To be aware that they're different and what they're missing out on is heartbreaking. Yeah. And also they're so vulnerable, because like the children in my class will always have carers, they'll always have advocates, they'll always have people fighting their corner, and they'll always be so loved and almost in a safe little bubble of love, actually, alongside all of the other things they've got, and got to deal with. Actually, they're always in this safe bubble of love. Often I'm attached to a mainstream school, and I see learners with the same diagnosis masking, having to cope, being treated as behavior, struggling to make friends, struggling to meet their needs, struggling to communicate, and my heart breaks for them.
And I think it's what's also important, it's not what advice do you have for the child, it's for they are who they are, and that is okay. Right, for everyone else, it's time for you to learn empathy and understanding about people around you and how everyone is different, and that is okay. So it's not just about the child fitting in. It's no, you fit around everyone else. You know, and I I've always said, I mean, I did work, my previous job was an ASD manager for a mainstream, an autism alongside a mainstream. And I'll be honest with you, I was there for 2.5 years. I set it up and it was a massive challenge. I was literally late 20s and it was a big role to go to be in a managerial role. But what I found the most challenging was exactly what you just said. I found it heartbreaking. Mm. That, you know, teenagers, 13-year-olds coming to me going, I know I'm different and I don't. And it, yeah, I used to come home and just be in tears because I just know how to help them. And I found that the most
mental health is the biggest risk for an autism diagnosis.
Yeah. But it was always, but my viewpoint was always right. Assemblies, two at a time, every single day for the other students in class. You learn kindness, empathy. Yeah. Compassion.
And it's shown they will follow the adult's lead.
Yes, and it did work every day. An activity, learning that empathy, compassion for other people, and the understanding when you saw.
Because if they're seeing, if the students are seeing a child getting told off or whatever for using their fidget or for making noises, not giving eye contact, all of those things that we probably hear all the time. They're going to learn that that's not normal. That's bad behavior. Yeah. These children are put on red and all of those things.
Yeah.
It breeds a culture of you must mask your needs to fit in, doesn't it? Whereas actually, if the teacher at the front and the supporting assistants are supportive of it, encouraging of it, understanding of it, it just breeds a culture that it's okay for everybody to meet their needs. Because let's face it, even if you're not, haven't got sensory regulation needs, if you've had some really bad news in the morning or if you've had a really bad weekend or there's a, you know, safeguarding concern or whatever, you might need a fidget that day, you might need more breaks that day. And it's almost like reading the culture of like, we all go have these times where we go through something and we need something extra and we need to be empathetic of all those times.
Absolutely.
But in the workplace too, with staff to staff, no children involved, it needs to be just part of the culture of the school. I think
definitely.
That's it for this week's episode. I hope you enjoyed taking a look back at some of my favorite moments from series one. If you would like to be on my podcast for series two, then please get in touch. You can email me at oursensorykids@gmail.com or just send me a DM on social media and I'd love to have you on. See you next time.